Well, I'm Teresa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Teresa.
I didn't get to hear Dave's tapes, and what I've been told about Dave is he is good AA, and I'm gonna get Mike to come up here and briefly introduce Dave for y'all, and that's it.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Erickson. I'm an alcoholic. July 19th of 87 is my sobriety date, and my home group's the Into Action group in Richardson, Texas. And I officially want to declare war on the Irving group, and the booty is Vera and her cakes. So I am I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be a part of this. So I want to thank Bunky. Had to leave early because his wife wasn't feeling good, and then I really appreciate the history that was given. And I want to thank Susan. She's my wife's sponsor, and Dave and Susan, Dave is my sponsor. And they are the single best example of a married couple and family recovery that I know of. Period. I can follow them because they've been where I've been. And I can do what they do because they do it. The thing I love about my sponsor is that, a couple things. He has a sponsor. I know who his sponsor is. I know that my sponsor has worked the steps. I know that he practices them in his life. I know that he is busier than I am in Alcoholics Anonymous. And because he's busier than me, he pulls me to a level that I'm incapable of getting to on my own resources. Left to my own devices, I will set the bar as low as possible so I don't trip over it as I stumble by. You know? And the thing that I think is most important about my sponsor is that I can follow him because when he makes mistakes, I get to watch him clean them up. I can follow someone like that. I can't follow someone who tells me what to do and doesn't do it. And with that, I give you my sponsor, David B. from Tulsa.
Hi, everybody. My name is David Braham, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David.
And I do want to thank Rob and the committee for allowing Susan and myself the great privilege of participating in your 50th anniversary of the Irving Group. You know, I have been taught that it is not my right, nor is it something I've earned or deserve. Do I ever get to stand in or participate in an AA meeting? It is simply a privilege, and to be allowed the privilege, the great privilege of sharing in your group's 50th anniversary is something that I do not take lightly. I want to thank all the people that had anything to do with, you know, putting it on. The people that were in the middle, that got here early, before this thing got started this morning, or have participated in setting it up, all the people that cooked the food, all the people that, you know, got the building ready, the cakes, the setup. You know, those are the things that require action. And I have a sponsor today, and I've had great sponsorship. I'm a product of solid AA sponsorship. I am the product of somebody who took the time to get sober in AA, understood the book Alcoholics Anonymous, more importantly, understood the disease of alcoholism, and stayed here so that somebody like me, when I got here on the second day of January in 1981, that the message was intact. Because today I am more convinced of one thing than just about anything else, and that's there's as much bad information in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous as there is good. And the unfortunate thing is a lot of people get stuck with the bad information, and they never get a chance at what's at the heart of recovery in AA. And I hope I don't ever forget that I am an alcoholic, and I was suffering from an illness. And an illness of sorts that is probably the greatest destroyer of human beings on the planet. Because not only does it kill alcoholics, but it destroys the lives of everybody around them. You know, and they say, I don't know who they are, but they love talking about it. They say that alcoholism affects 1 out of 10 people. So if Irving I think I saw your population sign, 169,000. I don't know if that's correct or not, but if Irving has a population of 169,000 people, then about 17,000 are alcoholics. And if we just look at the population of Irving and the groups that are in Irving, I would imagine that there's probably, you know, a very small number of sober alcoholics. Now you probably got about 15,000 budding alcoholics just driving around your streets today, wondering what the heck's going on in this building. A lot of smoke coming out of it. A lot of people looking like they just ate. A lot of people laughing. See, if I'm an alcoholic, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you know, those last days of drinking, I didn't laugh much. In fact, I'll tell you, probably for the first period of time in my recovery, I didn't laugh about anything. I was so angry when I came to you that I really sat there and you could tell I was angry. I didn't hide the fact that I was pissed. And I really enjoyed those people that would come to the podium of AA and go, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Yeah, I dare you to come tell me how grateful you are. I did not want to be here. I did not like being here. And I'll get into my story in just a little bit. You know, the idea of being able to be sober. You know, one of the things that my sponsor is, he's an avid buff of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not only the history of our program AA, but the history of the disease of alcoholism. And one of the things that he's uncovered is that there's now recorded human literature, recorded history of the human beings some 7,000 years back. 7,000 years of recorded human history. You know, and that we're living in a time and in a place where AA is available. That we're in a time and a place, and it's only been for 67 years that AA has been available. And we're in the place where it's probably in its most concentrated, purest form. We're in the country that AA was established. I don't know how many of you have had opportunities to go to the international conferences. I've gone to the last two, and when I sit and I talk to some of the people from the other countries, they talk about an AA that just has barely got started. AA's been in their country 2 years or 3 years. And they're hanging on to sobriety by a thread. And here your group has 50 years of sober experience to pass on. And sometimes I can take my sobriety for granted. Sometimes I act so contrite about my sobriety that I don't recognize the power of simply being sober. I don't understand or I don't want to take the time to recognize the absolute miracle of I have a day of sobriety. Somebody calls and said, would you come down early? No, I'm too busy. Can you help make something? No, don't have time. Can you get on the 12-step list? No, my business booming now, sorry. You know, and I think about just in the time, 67 out of 7,000 years, that alcoholics, our only result was death or insanity. That's it. That's the only two choices alcoholics of my type, the type that's described in our book, had, death or insanity. And right now, the terms of some of the history of the countries in today, how they treat alcoholics. They imprison us, bury us alive. They don't know what to do with us. We're a soul sickness on their society, so they don't know what to do with us, so they just plant us places and take us out of the mainstream. And yet I get the privilege of walking around today in a time and a place where there's actually a solution to the disease that's one and sole aim is to destroy me. So when somebody says, how grateful are you? What are you willing to do? Somebody says, can you do this for AA? Jesus, I'll do anything you ask. Just ask. So one more time, the privilege. I haven't earned anything. In fact, if I get what I deserve, you better leave the room. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I am just a garden variety drunk. You know, I know the first couple times I would stand behind some of the, or I'd listen to some of the people that get up behind podiums of Alcoholics Anonymous and tell their stories, and man, these guys had great stories. In fact, I want to make a little story about your brand new toilet. I heard an AA talk, and he gave the greatest description of a toilet for an alcoholic that I have ever heard. And it's the perfect example of my perception of as an alcoholic. Because my perception is my problem. I don't know about you, but I would go to those places, you know, and you'd go to those seedy places where alcoholics of my type drink. And at about 7 or 8 or 9 o'clock at night, when you're just getting started, and you'd have to, you know, nature would call, so you'd go into the bathroom. And man, you'd go into those bathrooms, and man, that's a bad place. And you're just so disgusted with it that, man, you just even lift the seat of the toilet up with your foot. You don't even want to touch it. It's so disgusting. About 4 or 5 in the morning, man, you got your head in it. I'm an alcoholic of that type. I'm a puker. Book describes alcoholism. The book describes my illness that I have. You know, it says, gives a description. If you're not sure if you're an alcoholic, and I think that's one of the most important things a group can do to a brand new person walking through the doors of AA is help them to determine, are they or are they not? Are they sitting in the place that they should be sitting in? This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is for people who suffer from the disease of alcoholism. Our book describes alcoholism, describes alcoholics. It says we alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. It's the best description of alcoholism I know. From what that description says, what I've gathered is there's only two types of alcoholics. We have some men alcoholics, and we have some women alcoholics. That's all we got. It's only two kinds we got here. We don't have young alcoholics and old alcoholics and green alcoholics and black alcoholics and white. But seemingly we want to make distinctions why I'm different. Today I know I'm an alcoholic that I had lost the ability to control my drinking. Now if I have some other set of problems, my sponsor taught me that AA cannot be all things to all people. Boy, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that I today recognize simply that the answer to my problem, alcoholism, is contained within the pages of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will be forever grateful for that. I grew up in a family, I've got two older brothers. My father was, I grew up in Chicago. My father was in the Chicago Cubs minor league system. He was a very good athlete, and athletics were a big part of my upbringing. Right from the beginning, I seemed to be different. My oldest brother was a pretty good athlete. The middle brother was the best. He was a letterman in high school in baseball, basketball, and football. And I was none of that. I seemingly got, you know, all the athletics seemed to go to those two. I was kind of fat and chubby. I mean, I didn't run very fast. I was gravity challenged. My freshman year, you know, Braves, we go out for football. So you go out for the football team. On the second day of football season, I found out I had a problem with my back. I found out that I have a big yellow streak right down the middle of it. I do not like getting hit. And, you know, football coaches, they have an awful big problem when the guy's running, they say tackle, and you just kind of step aside and go after you. They don't like that very much. Tried tennis. Tennis was a good sport for me, just so long as the guy didn't hit it back. You know, if I could get it past him the first thing, that was great. But after they hit it back, I kind of had trouble going from line to line. Then I found the game of golf. And golf was a perfect sport for a guy like me. What you find out quickly about the game of golf is after you hit it, you don't have to run after it. You can hit it and walk. Now, what I found out later as we progressed was, as you get far enough from the clubhouse, what you can do is you can hit it, light up a cigarette, and walk after it. Sooner or later, you start smoking other stuff after while you're walking after it. Now I find out you can hit it and get in something motorized and ride after it. And it's a perfect sport for a guy like me. I became very good at the game of golf fairly quickly, and by the time I was a senior in high school, I was playing to a one handicap, and I was competing at a high level. And and I had some people looking at the way that I played, and Bill's story talks about that there's, you know, we all have talents. We seem to have those things that we excel at. And sooner or later, if you're an alcoholic, you start making sacrifices. You start making decisions, because sooner or later, if you're an alcoholic of the book type, and the word that I'm going to use, because I know I am one, is hopeless. I want to not drink, but I have a craving for alcohol. And when I'm not drinking, sooner or later that craving becomes paramount to all other interests. I have to drink. There's no choice. I have to drink. The book describes me, in the doctor's opinion, as when I'm not drinking, it describes me as an alcoholic who's sober, that I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. That's describing me when I'm not drinking alcohol. Therefore, I must have a drink. Then it describes me if I drink alcohol. One of the things that happens is then I develop the phenomenon of craving. And that is the single most important aspect to determine, are you not an alcoholic? I believe there's an awful lot of people sitting in AA meetings aren't alcoholic. They've been sent here. Judge doesn't know if they're alcoholic. You know, just because you have a DUI doesn't make you alcoholic. You might just made a bad choice one night. You drank and drove. That don't make you alcoholic. Heck, you might have drank one night and beat your wife up. That don't make you alcoholic. Might have slapped a kid. That don't make you an alcoholic. Might have stole the money. That don't make you an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic and what distinguishes me from the rest of the 90% of the population is that when I drink alcohol, I develop the phenomenon of craving. And if I have that peculiar mental twist, then I am part of that part of the population that will sooner or later get to a place where drinking alcohol and alcoholism will take me to a place beyond human aid. And I didn't know I was suffering from it. I thought I was weak. See, because as growing up, my father taught me things like discipline and self-control and be a man. God, if I heard that one more time, I was going to scream. See, and I'll tell you the thing that makes me the most sick about myself is that I know what I'm doing is wrong and I can't stop. I know what I'm doing is wrong and I do not have the power to stop. Because I have a mind that keeps whispering to me a shot of Jack Daniels to take care of that. Then I'll tell myself, I'll rationalize, yeah, I can have one. I've gone on many of my worst drunks with starting off that night with going, you know what, I'll just go there and just have one or two. I graduated from high school, went through a junior college, played some college golf, won a college golf tournament, had some bright aspects, had some things going that were bright, but at this time I'm in full-fledged alcoholism. I barely graduated from that junior college, and I rolled in Northern Illinois University, which is in DeKalb, Illinois, which is about 40 miles north of Chicago. Pretty much in a cornfield. DeKalb, Illinois, what they did, it looks like, is they plowed out a bunch of the corn and put the university up, and that's it. You either went to class, drank at a bar, or walked around in your cornfield. Didn't look like there was much else going on. In fact, I can't tell you how many times I came to in the middle of a cornfield. That's kind of a spiritual experience when you're an alcoholic coming out of a blackout, looking at, like, vegetation higher than you can see, trying to find your way out of a cornfield. That's nice. One of the great events in a college atmosphere is Halloween, especially for an alcoholic. You can dress up just about anything you want to do. And I was hanging out with a bunch of goons, in 1980 a movie came out called The Warriors. It was a movie about gangs, so this bunch that I was hanging out with, we decided we were going to dress up like one of the gangs in the movie The Warriors. So we dressed up as this gang called the Baseball Furies. You painted your face red and white, wore a ball cap, wore a baseball uniform, and you carried a baseball bat. So I put the ball cap on, got the best thing I could close up as a baseball uniform. Didn't have a bat, but in my closet there was a 4-foot wood oak closet pole. So I took my closet pole to the party. Now by this time, every time I drink, I lose control. By this time, when I start drinking, only one of three things is going to happen. I'm going to run out, I'm going to pass out, or I'm going to black out, and that's it. By this time, those are my three options. I've run out several times. I've done things after running out of alcohol that you do when you run out of alcohol and you need a drink. You steal, you lie, you drink brands less than your brand. I've drank whiskey out of a squeezed out bar rag. I needed a drink so bad. So by this time I drink. Well, this particular night I black out. And the story that was told to me is that about 3 o'clock in the morning that this bunch saw me walking across DeKalb in a direction that was opposite of where I lived. And so they picked me up and they took me home. And they told me that when I walked into our downstairs neighbor's apartment that I had about this much left in my closet pole. And I was going, ooh, I was hurting people. See, I don't recall any of that night. I don't recall what occurred. The only thing I remember is I woke up the next morning and I had all that makeup on my pillow, and there was blood, and there was a lot of stuff, and they told me that story. And it scared me. So the next couple of days I started looking in the newspapers. I looked in the college newspaper. Most college newspapers have a little corner section that's some type of crime beat. They tell about all the nefarious crimes that were committed on the college campus, so I looked in there to see if anybody dressed up in a baseball uniform and a red and white painted face was beating on people with a closet pole. And I didn't find anything. So after a couple days of this, I did with this problem what I've done with every single problem that I've ever had up to this point. I just disregarded it. Because, you know, you didn't mean anything to me. By this time, I have no respect for you. I have no respect for any institution. I have no respect for regulations or rules. I don't have any respect for anything. Now, I am trying to go there to get an education. I live in an apartment with, you know, the book says we don't like to pronounce anybody alcoholic. That doesn't mean we don't do it. We just don't like to pronounce them, all right? I'm living with guys that certainly are showing all the signs. Our apartment appears to be alcoholic. The kitchen that me and these guys lived in had every plate, glass, cup, spoon, knife, fork, anything that was supposed to be in a cabinet or in a drawer was on the kitchen counter, and it was covered with various lengths of old food, 2 to 3 days, maybe 2 to 3 weeks. Some of the stuff was sitting in the sink that had that water that was fairly old. You know, the stuff was floating on the top. Paper products in our apartment, they varied. And normally, one of any of the three could substitute for any other of the three. We had three paper products: paper towels, coffee filters, or toilet or Kleenex. And they could all interchange for any one or the other. The carpet had kind of a alcoholic texture because a lot of stuff had been spilled in it, kind of soggy, crunchy, had that glaze to it. You know, when you step in it, the footprint would remain. One morning, I don't know, it was late November 1980, I had come to and I'm laying in my carpet. And I had an intuitive thought. I have a test. And so I look out the window, and kind of a day just like today, sun's shining. So I put my uniform of the day on, which consisted of my T-shirt, which I'd cut the sleeves off of, and proudly proclaimed across my chest, "Free me." Had a big fist on the back. It's kind of my call. Put my shorts on, put my thongs on. Kind of look like a newcomer coming at AA, basically, you know. Grab my number 2 pencil, walk to class. I don't know, it's about a mile and a half to the building where I'm taking my test at, and I get to the building where I'm taking my test at, and it's one of those auditorium style classes, so there's a lot of people in the class, and I look up and I got to find a seat so I can take my test. And immediately I recognize there's something completely different from all of you. Every single one of you as compared to me. I looked up and every single one of you in the class, my classmates, had heavy winter clothing on. I'm talking about the heavy stuff. This is Northern Illinois, and they're in the big, heavy winter coats and the gloves and the scarves and those pullover hats where only the eyes show. And as I was walking up the aisle to find a seat, I heard somebody say, "Geez, what does he know that we don't?" And see, because it's late November, and it's Northern Illinois, and it's freaking cold outside. But you see, when I pulled my face out of my carpet that morning and came to and looked out the window, and this is about the intelligence factor that I had when I came to you. I looked out the window, and the only thought that came to my mind was sun, warm, free me. And that's pretty much how I came to you. That's pretty much the intelligence factor that I had when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Right after that semester ended, I my grade point, I think, sunk to an all-time low, like 0.8. It's hard to score when you're not at class. And I remember I got caught one afternoon at the university bookstore for theft. Stole a Conte crayon. Now, I'd had a bunch of money in my pocket, but you know, one of the classes I was taking was art, and I needed about an 89-cent Conte crayon, and I didn't want to give up any of my money, so I thought I'd plan the heist. Failed. Got caught stealing a Conte crayon. It's kind of it's hard to be rough and tough and cool when you get caught stealing a Conte crayon. But I go home for the semester, and it's, you know, so it's in, you know, it's right before Christmas and the semester's over, and I don't know how many times I had come home drunk. I don't know how many times I had stolen my parents' stuff. I can't tell you how many times my parents looked at me with total despair. I've lied to them everything I could lie. I've stolen. I've done just about everything. I can't tell you how many times they have found me passed out in puddles of my own vomit. You know, the doctor's opinion talks about a paragraph that is in clarity and etched in my mind about frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. See, I have a picture of froth emotional appeal. I have a picture of my mom just pleading with me, "Stop drinking. You're killing us. Stop drinking. We cannot take it." And those little puddles of the white spittle were gathering at the corner of her mouth. That's froth, baby. Man, she was appealing. So I have a clear understanding of frothy emotional appeal. So between the Christmas and the New Year's holiday, my father, his company has a holiday party, so my mom and my dad go to the holiday party, and this seems like a perfect opportunity for me to have kind of one of those Hallmark moments and, you know, have the fire going and invite a few close friends over. It's one of those times where you make a call and you invite two or three people over and about 55 show up. And see, I start drinking, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a hopeless alcoholic. I don't know what's going to happen. When I start to drink, I lose all control of my drinking. And I don't know the majority of the people that are in my parents' home. It's not my home, it's their home. It's their stuff, their money. And I pass out. And I'm over in the corner like some pile of trash, passed out. Now my folks' home is left laid waste by this band of friends. And my parents' stuff is stolen. And, you know, just to give you an example, one of the things that happened was in my parents' upstairs bedroom, they had they had a lockbox with all the house papers, the deeds and the wills and all the stuff. 3 or 4 days later, they found that box that was in their bedroom upstairs, beaten to within an inch of its life, jammed behind the furnace in the basement. Now, there's no lie that you can tell that. Now, how'd that happen? You cannot tell a lie good enough to just make something like that up. I mean, the very last thing before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous is he looked me in the eye with all the contempt and hatred that a man can have for another man, not to say a father for his son, My father looked me in the eye and he said, with a son like you, I do not need any enemies. I had stolen, I had ripped, I had taken from him everything good and decent. And there's no amount of time that I have that I can make that right. He hated me, and he had every right to hate me. I certainly wasn't acting like a son to him. And that's the person that walked to you. That's the person that walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on January 2nd, 1981. And I didn't know if I was alcoholic. If that day somebody would have come up to me and said, "Dave, are you an alcoholic?" I couldn't have told you truthfully. I would not have been able to answer that. I knew something was wrong. But I don't know if I could have said truthfully on that day if somebody would have asked me, "Are you alcoholic?" Because I thought an alcoholic was somebody living under the bridge in some trench coat, picking dog food out of their teeth. I mean, I don't know what an alcoholic is. And I was 20 years old. So now, what do you do? Very next day, for whatever reason, they had decided they were going to plead with me one more time. And they asked me if I needed, you know, what are you going to do? Because we can't stand it. We're not going to allow you to live here anymore. And some words came out of my mouth that day that have never came out of my mouth. I've heard several people from behind a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about a moment of clarity. And for me, my moment of clarity wasn't that I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what that was. I'll tell you what my moment of clarity was, is that, and this is the words I used that day, if I'm going to stop drinking, I'm going to need help. I had a surrender that day that I knew that I was fighting something that was beyond my power. I couldn't have labeled it alcoholism that day. I can label it today, it's alcoholism. You know, there's a passage in our book called How It Works, and it says, "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path," and then the next sentence says, "Those who do not recover." And there's a great percentage of people sitting in AA that will not recover. There's people sitting in right here today that maybe are a day or a week or a month away from taking that next drink. It says people who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. I believe on that day I was ready to completely give myself to anything other than the way I was living. Now that one day, that's great. But that day didn't cement my sobriety. That day started it. I have to have a surrender like that every day. I have to be willing to go to any lengths every day. Because I am an alcoholic of our book type. So I got whooshed off to this treatment center. I went through a 28-day treatment center. Treatment has absolutely nothing to do with my recovery. They allowed me to sleep in a clean bed for 28 days. 28 days later, they gave me my $10,000 big book. Told me to go to AA. I went to a halfway house. Halfway house, I don't know what it's halfway to or from. Went through one of those for about 4 or 5 months. Now I look at it as kind of a bizarre concept. You stick 15 or 20 brand new people all in the same place. Now there's 20 or 15 or 20 people with a lot of good ideas. I met a guy, first friend I ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got sober about the same day. We went to a lot of meetings together. We sat in the back row, made fun of everybody else in AA. I wasn't about to start working your steps, but I sat in your meetings. And then one day he got drunk. Scared me, so I went to see him. Thought I could save him. Now, I haven't worked any of your steps yet. I don't know any of your information, but I thought I knew enough to save him. So I walk in his apartment, and he's in a recliner, and he's already polished off about half a case, and he's got that glazed look going. It looks pretty good to me. He goes, "You want a beer?" Now, I'm not happy about my sobriety. I walked out, and I said, "No." I said, But in that moment, I made a decision that A don't work. I made the decision right there. A doesn't work. This guy's drunk. But I said, no, I'm going to go to a meeting. If you want to come, come. I haven't heard from him. That was 22 years ago. Went to a meeting that night to resign from AA. I didn't know that you just stopped going. So I went there to quit AA. I'm coming up with my speech. The guy that's leading the meeting is obviously concerned, so he really tries to avoid calling on me because I must have looked new. And he ran out of time before he ran out of people, so he had to call on me. And for about the next 4 or 5 minutes of an AA meeting, I said some of the most inappropriate, vile, profanity-laced things said in an AA meeting probably has ever seen. I'm probably bragging. But I told you all about why AA didn't work. I told you a bunch of losers. I told you a bunch of liars. My friend's drunk tonight. This thing doesn't work. I think you're all a bunch of mindless sheep. I can't believe that I spent all my time sitting in these meetings. Oh, yeah, and I want my money back. Like I'd been putting any money in your basket. And the guy that was leading the meetings did something very important to me, or for me, that day. He said, Dave, shut up. We are tired of listening to your crap. He said, Dave, it's real obviously that you're probably in your last moments of your sobriety, so I'm going to try to say something to you, and I hope that you hear it. He said, two things that I want you to understand. Number one, the reason that your buddy's drunk tonight isn't that AA doesn't work. The reason that your buddy's drunk tonight is that man has chosen not to work AA. Secondly, and most importantly, the thing that I want you to understand is there's two types of people sitting in this meeting tonight, this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said there's some of the people sitting here that are good examples of AA. He said there's an awful lot of people sitting in this meeting tonight that are bad examples of AA. Now pick the one that you want to be and shut up. I had my first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. How dare him? How dare him talk to me like that? But he was right. See, there's good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't know what they were. I started finding out. I started finding out things about people that were good examples of Alcoholics Anonymous, some principles that they lived by. You know, I appreciated the history of your group. I appreciated you going through how your group started and the people's sacrifice that started this group. But a lot of your new members probably don't know who any of those people are. But mostly what's as equally important as the people is what the principles are. What are the principles of this group? I think the new people need to understand what the principles of AA are. My sponsor started teaching me what the principles of AA are. Number one, showing respect for it. I didn't know that that was a principle of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we actually show respect for the meeting of AA. We don't get up during the meeting and walk around. Regardless of the level of your coffee cup, you don't go to a meeting and start drinking coffee. My sponsor started getting in my face. What are you here for, Dave? I'm here for the AA meeting. Doesn't look like it. Looks like you're here to smoke cigarettes and drink coffee. See, I didn't realize I was interrupting the meeting while I'm doing all the getting up and down. Well, I got to go to the bathroom. Well, if you stop drinking so much coffee, you don't have to go. If you can't go an hour without having a cup of coffee, something's wrong with you. Get one cup. Sit down. Ooh. My God, you're a little adamant about this, aren't you? This is AA. We're supposed to be free here. Supposed to be able to just be lovey-dovey. I heard there's no rules. Wrong. Turn to this page. He knew the book. He turned me to the page, and the doctor's opinion said, only requirement, follow a few simple rules. There's rules. And he goes, now we even have a stronger word than that. Turn to this page. And he turned to another page. And there's a word on the first page of how it works. And it says, demands. Not only are there rules, but there are demands. And this is a program that demands things of its members. Now, which members? All of us. But what I have found out is that there are two types of people in AA, good examples, bad examples. Good examples are willing to do whatever it takes. Good examples do whatever it takes. Bad examples rebel. They wear my shirt. That is the swan song of somebody who has not surrendered yet. Would you come here early? Would you stay in your seat? Would you not drink coffee? My book tells me that my problem is I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, that I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And my sponsor throws in a sixth, self-serving. It's like my constant companions, my constant six-pack of companions. Selfishness, self-centeredness, self-delusion, self-pity, self-seeking, and self-serving. And see, with that group of people, those are my constant companions. That's my natural state, not drinking. I can rationalize and justify every bad action if I get some of my buddies to come with me. Selfishness, I can drink coffee. It's my right. Get up. I'm self-serving. I can do whatever I want. I deserve it. Now, these are the things that I was taught, and I am so grateful. At my meeting, we have a little plaque right above our podium. It's just four little principles that our group's founded on. The first one's respect. Second one, sponsorship. Third one is commitment to the home group. And the fourth one's a little word our book uses called altruism. We place the welfare of others above our own. That's what our group's founded on. And we try to live by them. But I'll tell you, if you're an alcoholic of my type, I'm going to go down with every last breath before I turn myself into that. So I got a sponsor who started working me through the steps. You know, we've talked about, one of the things that Bunky talked about was his relationship with God and Bob White. And I never met Bob White, but I met one of the people that Bob's, one of the guys that claimed Bob as a hero, and that's a guy by the name of Jack Clater down in Austin. And Jack and Pat are great heroes of mine and Susan's. And Jack was somebody that looked up to Bob White. And my sponsor before he passed away in 1996 was a man by the name of Jim Shaw. And between Jim Shaw and Jack Clater, these are the two men that shaped my sobriety. They taught me about the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. They taught me about things like honesty. They taught me things about that we show respect, that we work these steps, that we're going to clean house. And then when you get your house clean, you know what? What I really found out was I always wanted a relationship with God. I honestly wanted a relationship with God, but I knew my house was so dirty that I didn't deserve a relationship with God. How could I have a relationship with God carrying all those lies and that stealing and that theft and acts of violence against other people? How could I have a relationship with God? Every time I tried to pray, I felt like such a hypocrite, I just stopped it. And your program, your steps 4 through 9, allow somebody like me, no matter what my grievances, no matter how far down the scale I've gone, your steps 4 through 9, if I have a sponsor who understands the process and is willing to tell me the truth about myself, can take me through that set of principles 4 through 9. That when I'm through, Bunky read the promises, when I'm through, I have an opportunity to look into my home, my soul, and it's clean enough to ask God in. If I'm honest and thorough about that phase of my development, and the book says pain's taking, if I'm willing to take on some pain about cleaning up my past, I can have a relationship with God. And I didn't know it until I had somebody take me through that book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found in that book that I'm one of you, that I now belong, that I have a place that I belong, that I fit. My whole life I felt like nobody understood me, that I don't fit. And now I have a place that I fit. Now that my house is clean, my job from that day forward is to try to pass this opportunity on to as many people who are willing to stand here and take it. And if your group's like our group, the majority of people that come through are visitors. They come through and they pass right back out. And every so often you get one that sticks. If you're brand new in this meeting, the Irving group, If you're brand new to Alcoholics Anonymous, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope you find here somebody who understands the disease of alcoholism, and I hope you find here somebody who has understood and has worked those steps that they can lead you through them. Susan described that we lived in this town, Norman, Oklahoma, and we got part of that group. It was active. It was a group that was heavy into sponsorship and heavy into fellowship and heavy into enjoying our sobriety. But when sobriety's call came and we had to carry the message, that was priority. Our primary purpose is to carry the message. We put everything else aside. And that group showed us that's what we do. We carry the message. We went to carry message to AAs. We went to carry messages to suffering Al-Anons. We did whatever it took because we were trying to show somebody that they had an opportunity to live by a set of principles that no matter what their circumstances were, they could live happy. And she described that, you know, we had known each other for a couple years prior to that fateful day. And she came home from a conference and I met her over. She invited me over for dinner and she was cooking. I went into the kitchen and she turned around and I kissed her. I was about 4 years sober at this point. And she did something that hadn't happened to me in a while. She kissed me back. Now, although I'd been sober 4 years, I still got a mind just kind of sun warm. And so I did the very next logical thing in my mind. I moved in. And so we were doing the deal for a little while, and one night we were laying in bed and Susan asked me a question that, ladies, this is really a very dangerous question. She asked me, "Dave, what are you thinking?" That's a bad question. And I answered her, and before I could get the answer back in my mouth, it was out. It was a bad answer. I said, "I don't think I can marry you, baby." Wrong answer. "Thank you for playing our game. We have some nice departing gifts for you on the way out." Out the door I go. Now I'm 4.5 years sober, or 4 years sober, and man, this is a bad deal. And Susan talked about her sponsor, Vinoy, and Jim and Vinoy were in Norman at that time, and Susan went, basically moved into Vinoy's house. Jim was not my sponsor at this point yet, and every Saturday night after our speakers meeting, the deal was everybody would go over to Jim and Vinoy's house and we'd play Trivial Pursuit, and we would laugh and laugh at our own stupidity. I mean, that game can just prove just how really dumb you are. And we would just laugh at each other, how stupid you really are. I mean, oh, you're so stupid. And women would cheat, and the guys would, you know, it was just unbelievable. And so now the Saturday night after we broke up, the Saturday night meeting is starting to, you know, it's breaking up, and everybody's going, "Let's go over to Jim and Vinoy's." Now I'm 4 years sober, I'm sponsoring guys, I'm taking meetings into prison, I'm active, and all of a sudden something comes to my head. Man, I'm not welcome. That's a bad thought for an alcoholic. It got so to where that was just the only thought in my face. You're not welcome. They don't like you. Man, I can still visualize. It was like a curtain just came down. Now I'm so mad I have to drive by. Everybody's laughing. I slowed the car down. I rolled the window down. I did a drive-by listen. And the very next thought that came to my mind was, screw it, what's the use? Might as well go get drunk. So I put the car to drive to go get drunk, and the amazing thing happened. I had never had a drink in Norman. I didn't know where to go. I had to stop the car. I had to physically, where do you go to get drunk? Can you get drunk in Norman? Do I got to drive all the way to Oklahoma City to get drunk? I could. And God stopped me long enough to give me a little boost. And I don't think if God would have came in the car that night, I know that you'd have a different speaker. He whispered in my ear, "Go see if Chip's home," another member of our group. So I drove over to Chip's house. Chip was home. So I go into Chip's house and start bawling and crying and blowing snot and taking all your inventories. Got the poison out. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. I didn't need to drink that night. The very next Saturday night, Susan had heard a joke she told you about that she's raised Texan. I'm a full-blood Yankee. So she had heard a joke. She came up to me and said, "What's the difference between a Yankee and a bucket of crap?" "The bucket." If I could have had laser beams shoot out of my eyes, I would have blown an arm off and another arm off. But since I couldn't do it with any of those, I came up with what I thought was my best thinking, and so I married her. And on August 3rd of 1985, we got married, and like she said, we celebrated 17 years last August. We're coming up on 18 years, and I'm the most privileged man there is. She's an active member of Al-Anon, and she works these principles, and I'm an active member of AA, and I, to the best of my ability, I try to work these principles. And we have an AA and Al-Anon home, and our home is yours. We had nothing when we got here. We had nothing. And everything we have is because of these principles, and you're welcome in our home at any moment. It's your home. You gave it to us. I'm not inviting you to come over and take our stuff. But we know that God's in the middle of our marriage. And every year we have a conference that we go to up in Oklahoma. It's called the Canyon Conference. And every year at the end of that conference, there's a little chapel on the grounds of the Canyon Conference. And at the end of the conference, every single year at the end, we go in there and we go into the middle of the chapel and we get on our knees and we do a third step prayer in our marriage. And we invite God one more time to come into the middle of our marriage. Because we know that God's at the center of what's going on. And then we stand up and we take off our rings and we re-say our vows every single year at the Canyon Conference. And I don't know of a more spiritual act than to tell the woman that I love every single year that I love her and I'm grateful to be married to her. But I couldn't have had any of it if it wasn't for the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles of AA and Al-Anon work in our lives. I told you about those parents, and I'll finish with this, is that I don't know, I guess it was 93. By this time, my mother, you know, I've come to find out that my family is also full of a bunch of alcoholics on both sides. My dad's family, a bunch of alcoholics. My mom's a bunch of drug addicts and alcoholics. And I had no chance. I thought I was the only alcoholic in the family. Man, our alcoholic bloodline goes way back. And one of the hardest things to do is watch alcoholism start to destroy my mother's life. And alcoholism is an ugly illness, and I just, you know, what I saw was it was just starting to just tear my mother apart. And by this time, she had already started the signs of cirrhosis of the liver, and she was pale, and she wasn't eating, and it was just ugly. And I would call Jim, and about the only complaint I had is it's hard to watch it. We would go every once a year or twice a year to my parents, and it was the only time we'd fight is watching my mom's alcoholism and my father's untreated Al-Anonism. And he's a rager all by himself. And I just knew my mom was going to die. And my sponsor kept telling me the story of his father who got sober when he was 78. And he said, "Partner, I don't know what we're going to do, and I don't know what God's got in store, but we're just going to keep praying, and you just go be the best son you could be." And so I did all the repair work that I could possibly do during that time. And the thing that happened is on January 8th of 1993, my father, through a series of circumstances, lost his job, and so he was home, and he got up one night about 2 or 3 in the morning, and my mother wasn't in the bed, and he walked and he tried to find her, and he found her in the kitchen chugging down a bottle of vodka. And the next morning I got a call and he asked me, "What do we do?" And so we talked, and he called me later and he said, "We've just put your mom in a treatment center." And on the 8th day of January in 1994, a year later, I got to stand up at a meeting in Sarasota, Florida, and I got to hand my mom her 1 year sober medallion. And on her 5 year birthday on January 8th, I got to stand up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I got to hand her a sober 5 year medallion. And this January, we couldn't get to Sarasota, so we invited my mom and dad here. And so a month ago, I got to stand up in my home group's meeting, and I got to hand my mom her 10-year sober medallion. And in that meeting, my father got to stand up and he got to participate in an AA meeting and he got to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous for his son and his wife back. And a lot of people ask me, man, Dave, you're pretty serious about this. You need to calm down. And my answer is, no, I don't. See, if you don't want to be serious about your recovery, that's your deal. But you won't come into my meeting, you won't come into the group that I belong to and disturb our meeting, I can promise you. Because you may not want to be sober, but somebody's mother might, or somebody's father might, or somebody's sister might, or somebody's brother or son or daughter or granddaughter might need AA, and if you're disturbing it, shame on you. If your cup of coffee is more important than letting somebody get sober, I have a problem with that. What goes on here is life and death. What goes on here is the difference between somebody's chance of sobriety and somebody not getting it. And if that doesn't mean anything to you, then maybe you haven't been taught. But if you've been taught and you're disregarding it, I'd plead with you to please change your course. You know, I've been given a life in Alcoholics Anonymous that a liar and a thief and somebody who totally disregards the other people walking around on this planet God's given us. I've been given a life that I don't deserve. There aren't many days that I don't wake up and I don't thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's because of Alcoholics Anonymous and your principles that today I have a relationship with God, and for that I'll always be grateful. Thank you for allowing me the privilege. And I owe you the money. I broke your glass.